1894, Chapter 13, Georgia from Confederation to Constitution. Chapter Preview, Terms, Articles of Confederation, Unicameral, Credit, Tuition, Great Compromise, United States Constitution, Electoral College, Federalist, Anti-Federalist, Bill of Rights, Secede. People: Alexander McGillivray, Alexander Baldwin, William Few, William Pierce, William Houston. Places: Louisville, Northwest Territory, Philadelphia. In 1783, the United States and France signed a peace treaty with the British after more than a year of negotiations. America's representatives at these talks were Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and John Jay. In the Treaty of Paris, the British recognized the independence of the new nation and agreed to the Mississippi River as its western boundary. This was a generous settlement since the colonies did not have control of most of the land west of the Appalachians. Great Britain kept Canada, but the Spanish, who had helped the French, got Florida back. With the war over, the former colonies had to establish themselves as a nation, form new trade patterns, and govern themselves with no help from across the sea. Georgia, too, had to adjust to its new status and rebuild its economy and society. When the first government after the Revolution needed changes, Georgia supported the idea and the new government that resulted. Page 296, Section 1, Georgia under the Confederation Government. As you read, look for the first government of the United States, how Georgia handled land confiscated from the Loyalist, relations with the Native Americans after the war, terms, Articles of Confederation, unicameral. For several years, Georgia and the other 12 states lived under their first experiment in self-government, a confederation. They had problems, however, with money, trade, and relationships with other countries and with the Native Americans whose nations were within the state's own borders. During this confederation period, Georgia began rebuilding after the destruction caused by the Revolution and the exodus of Loyalists, British officials, and slaves. Part of the rebuilding was trying to solve the state's problems of finances, land, and Native Americans. The Articles of Confederation. For much of the American Revolution, the government of the United States had been the Second Continental Congress. In 1781, after years of negotiations concerning overlapping claims to the land west of the Appalachian Mountains, the states had formed a confederation. In the confederation, the power to govern remained mainly in the states. The central government was limited to certain actions needed by the whole group. The way the government operated was outlined in the document that established it, the Articles of Confederation. The main functions of the Confederation government were to defend the country, pay its debts, settle arguments between the states, maintain relationships with other countries, and set up a postal service for mail going between the states. The Confederation had no executive branch of government because the ex-colonies remembered the executive power of the king and royal governors. There was also no court system. The judicial functions were handled within each state. The government was a unicameral, one-house legislature that worked by forming committees to deal with specific tasks. Even the powers of the legislature were limited. It could not tax and could not regulate trade between the states or with foreign nations. In the legislature, each state had one vote, but the measures the Confederation Congress approved were not supreme over laws passed by the states. To change anything about the articles, every state had to agree. That made change very difficult. The government that most affected a citizen in this early United States was the state government. Georgia's government. At the end of the war, Georgia's government was based on the Constitution of 1777. The state government did have an executive branch. However, the executive powers were shared by a governor and a council. As discussed in Chapter 12, the executive branch was weak. The governor had no veto or pardon power. The legislature held most power. Georgia did have a court system. The superior court in each county was the major institution of county government, overseeing elections, controlling roads, and providing aid for the poor. Sometimes a special commission was set up in a county by the assembly to address a particular problem or carry out a specific function. For example, if a stream or river needed to be cleaned out to make it more navigable, the assembly would set up a special commission. The main issues facing the new state involved overcoming the problems left by the war, how to rebuild Georgia's buildings and farms, pay the state's debts, and establish better relationships with the Creek and the Cherokee. Land. When the soldiers returned home from the Revolutionary War, some found their cattle gone and their buildings in ruin. Many slaves had either left with the British or run away, so planters did not have enough labor. As one former planter said, Georgians would have to begin the world again. Land was still the most important issue for most citizens. The personal wealth of most Georgians was in land, not cash. With land, a farmer could cut his own wood for fuel, grow food for his family and his animals, and make a little cash to pay for any goods he could not produce himself. For wealthy planters, land allowed them to produce large amounts of cash crops, which provided money to have not only necessities, but also luxuries. One question the new government faced was what to do with land that had belonged to Loyalists. Many Georgia Loyalists wanted to return, especially when those who had gone to East Florida learned that Great Britain had given up East and West Florida in the Treaty of Paris. Near the end of the war, after the Patriots had taken control of Georgia, some Loyalists had regained their citizenship by enlisting in the Continental troops. Those who had not done this had to make a formal request to return. The state did not permit the return of Loyalists who had most actively opposed the Patriot cause. Some, especially if they had helped the Patriots, or at least tried to stay out of the fighting, were allowed to resume their lives in Georgia. Loyalists who either did not want to return or whose return applications were rejected lost their property. The state confiscated it, took it over, and hoped to make money by selling it. In the coastal area, leading patriots wanted the old rice lands of former wealthy Loyalists. Royal Governor James Wright not only lost his position as governor, but his livelihood and home. He left behind many plantations totaling over 25,000 acres and valued at £33,000. While the British government did eventually grant him a pension for his service, he was never compensated for the losses his loyalty had cost him. Soldiers in both the state militia and the Continental Army, including those from other states who had fought for independence in Georgia, could receive land for their service. This was called a bounty grant. The amount of land received depended on the rank of the soldier. The higher the rank, the more land. Privates got 200 acres. Colonel Elijah Clark received several thousand acres. In 1784, two new counties, Washington and Franklin, were laid out with sections reserved for war veterans who were to receive grants. Many settlers came to Georgia because the state continued to grant, give, land by the headright system. For example, in 1782, the head of a family had the right to receive 200 acres of land plus 50 acres for every additional household member. The headright grant was supposed to be limited to 1,000 acres, but that limit was often ignored. With the help of the Loyalists removed, hundreds of settlers moved onto land in the backcountry. Most were small farmers. Settlers moving from other states came mainly from Virginia and the Carolinas. Some did come down the Great Wagon Road from Pennsylvania and other northern states. The backcountry began to fill up with those whose hopes for themselves and their children centered around owning and working their own farms. The growing importance of the areas away from the coast resulted in the Assembly's decision to move the capital further into the interior. In 1786, the Assembly voted to find a new site for the capital. A new town, to be called Louisville, was ordered, built on the Ogeechee River near George Galphin's old trading post. Until it was completed, Augusta served as the capital for 10 years. Indian relations. As the colonies were settled, many colonial charters granted land in areas that extended beyond the Appalachian Mountains. Often those lands overlapped. During the Revolutionary War, to settle disputes among themselves over the land claims west of the Appalachians, the states north of the Ohio River gave up their claims. The Confederation as a whole now owned what was called the Northwest Territory. It eventually became 5 states, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Michigan. The southern states held on to their land because their claims to land all the way to the Mississippi River were clearer. Georgia's western claims included land that is today Alabama and Mississippi. Everything west of the Ogeechee River, however, was still claimed by the Creek. The Cherokee claimed the northern area of the state. Settlers began to fill up the fertile land the Indians had given up in the 1763 and 1773 treaties. If the Revolutionary War had not disrupted settlement, these areas would probably have been settled even earlier. Georgia came under increased pressure to get more land from the Indians. The land between the Ogeechee and Oconee Rivers was particularly attractive. Many hoped that land north of the 1773 agreement would be opened as well. Although Georgia hoped to gain new land, it wanted to do it without causing major conflict with the Native Americans. Establishing good relationships with the Indians was very important, since many of them had not supported the American cause for independence. The fur trade had also been damaged by the war. Most of the traders had been loyalist, who were now gone or who had died. In some areas, the deer population had also declined from so much hunting. The first meeting after the fighting ended was with the Cherokee. At a meeting at Long Swamp in October 1782, the Cherokee agreed to give up land west of the Savannah River and south and west of the Tugalo River. This land was directly above the 1773 treaty land. In 1783, at a meeting in Augusta, the Cherokee reconfirmed their commitment, and the Lower Creek agreed to give up their claim to that same area. Some, but not all, of the Creek agreed to give up Creek land east of the Oconee River. The Upper Creek was totally opposed to ceding more land and would not sign the 1783 Treaty of Augusta. Their leader was Alexander McGillivray. For years, he resisted all attempts by whites to acquire more Creek land. He said that since he and his followers had not agreed to the 1783 treaty, Georgia's claims to the land were illegal. He even looked for help to the Spanish officials who came to Florida in 1783. Georgia leaders called more meetings with the Creek in the 1780s. The Lower Creek agreed to 2 more treaties at Galphinton, 1785, and Shoulderbone, 1786. McGillivray never supported those treaties. He continued to demand that all settlers get out of the territory beyond the Ogeechee River. At times, war seemed possible. Unable to solve these difficulties in its relationship with the Creek, Georgia often asked for help from the Confederation government. But the Confederation government was weak and not much help. By the late 1780s, the issue of Creek lands had not been solved, and Georgians were eager to finalize a treaty. Finances. Another major problem for the young state government was money. During the war, the government had many expenses, but not much income. While the British were in control of Savannah, the Patriot government had not been able to tax and so had no money. Although the Patriots had printed money during the war, the money had little value, and people could not buy goods with it. By the end of the war, Georgia was in debt. Some of the debts were to its own citizens, who had given supplies to the troops. They expected the government to pay them back after the war. Georgia's government also needed money for such expenses as having meetings to make treaties with the Indians. The Confederation as a whole also had debts from the war. Although the Confederation government could not tax, it did ask each state for money to help pay the national debt. The state of Georgia hoped to get money through the sale of property confiscated from Loyalists, especially rice planters. Money, however, was scarce. Even when those lands were sold, payment was slow. At this time, there was no income or sales tax. A tax on land was the main source of income for the government. The state's finances gradually improved as the economy improved and more taxes and land payments were collected. However, it took many years before all Georgia's financial problems were solved. Reviewing the section. 1. Define unicameral. 2. What document established the first government of the United States? 3. Which tribe resisted ceding land to the state of Georgia? 4. How did Georgia get money for its government? Page 303, Georgia Portraits, Alexander McGillivray. Alexander McGillivray is a good example of how the British and the Native Americans became united not only by trade, but sometimes by blood. On his father's side, Alexander belonged to the Clan Chattan of Scotland. On his mother's, to the powerful Wind Clan of the Creek. His father, Lachlan McGillivray, migrated to Georgia as one of the Highland Scots Oglethorpe recruited in 1735. By 1741, Lachlan could speak the Creek language, and in 1744 he received a license as a trader to several Creek towns. Lachlan took Sahoy Marchand, daughter of a Creek mother and French trader, as his wife. On December 15, 1750, their son Alexander was born. He was named in honor of the head of Clan Chattan, who had died bravely in battle. The young boy lived in several family homes during his childhood, in Creek country, in Augusta where his father had a store, in Charleston where he received an education, and in Savannah where he was an apprentice for merchants. People noticed his education and his talents. At age 25, Alexander decided to return to his mother's people. Since power among the Creek descended through the mother's line, Alexander had a place of leadership. During the American Revolution, both Lachlan and Alexander were loyal to the British cause. Beginning in 1778, Alexander served as deputy to the Upper Creek towns. In 1783, his people appointed him head warrior of all the nation. After the war, Alexander tried to bring all the Creek together in a stronger nation with more central power. He was firmly against ceding additional lands to the state of Georgia. When George Washington became president, he invited Alexander to come to the capital, which was then New York. Washington graciously welcomed McGillivray and his chiefs to his home. Abigail Adams, wife of Vice President John Adams, observed that McGillivray was much of a gentleman. On that trip, Alexander and his chiefs agreed to the Treaty of New York, which moved the boundary of Creek lands to the Oconee River. On the occasion, President Washington gave McGillivray a set of books, which the chief prized. In 1793, at the age of 43, Alexander McGillivray died on a trip to Pensacola.